Part 3. The Dreadful Sagittary. One. As an unexpected sequel to the War on Murder, they became the guests of the Interrex. And right from the start of their sojourn, voices had begun to call for war. Eidolon was one, and a vociferous one at that. But Eidolon was out of favour and easy to dismiss. Malagost was another, and so too were Sedere and Targost and Goshen and Raldoron of the Blood Angels. Such men were not so easy to ignore. Sanguinius kept his counsel, waiting for the War Master's decision, understanding that Horus needed his brother Primarch's unequivocal support. The argument, best summarized by Malagost, ran as follows. The people of the Interrex are of our blood, and we descend from common ancestry, so they are lost kin. But they differ from us in fundamental ways, and these are so profound, so inescapable, that they are cause for legitimate war. They contradict absolutely the essential tenets of imperial culture as expressed by the Emperor, and such contradictions cannot be tolerated. For the while, Horus tolerated them well enough. Logan could understand why. The warriors of the Interrex were easy to admire, easy to like. They were gracious and noble, and once the misunderstanding had been explained, utterly without hostility. It took a strange incident for Logan to learn the truth behind the War Master's thinking. It took place during the voyage, the 9-week voyage from Murder to the nearest outpost world of the Interrex. The mingled ships of the expedition and its hangers-on, trailing the sleek vessels of the Interrex flotilla. The Morneval had come to Horus's private staterooms, and a bitter row had erupted. Abaddon had been swayed by the arguments for war. Both Malagust and Sedere had been whispering in his ear. He was convinced enough to face the War Master and not back down. Voices had been raised. Logan had watched in growing amazement as Abaddon and the War Master bellowed at each other. Logan had seen Abaddon wrathful before, in the heat of combat, but he had never seen the commander so ill-tempered. Horus's fury startled him a little, almost scared him. As ever, Torgadon was trying to defuse the confrontation with levity. Logan could see that even Taric was dismayed by the anger on show. "You have no choice," Abaddon snarled. "We have seen enough already to know that their ways are in opposition to ours. You must—" "Must," Horus roared. "Must I? You are Morneval, Abaddon. You advise and you counsel, and that is your place. Do not imagine you can tell me what to do."
"I don't have to. There is no choice, and you know what must be done."
"Get out."
"You know it in your heart."
"Get out,"
Horus yelled, and cast aside his drinking cup with such force it shattered on the steel deck. He glared at Abaddon, teeth clenched.
"Get out, Ezekiel, before I look to find another first captain."
Abaddon glowered back for a moment, spat on the floor, and stormed from the chamber. The others stood in stunned silence. Horus turned, his head bowed.
"Torgadon," he said quietly.
"Lord, yes?"
"Go after him, please. Calm him down. Tell him if he craves my forgiveness in an hour or two, I might soften enough to hear him. But he'd better be on his knees when he does it, and his voice had better not rise above a whisper."
Torgadon bowed and left the chamber immediately. Logan and Aximand glanced at one another, made an awkward salute, and turned to follow him out.
"You two stay," Horus growled.
They stopped in their tracks. When they turned back, they saw the War Master was shaking his head, wiping a hand across his mouth. A kind of smile informed his wide-set eyes.
"Throne, my sons. How the molten core of Chthonia burns in us sometimes."
Horus sat down on one of the long, cushioned couches, and waved to them with a casual flick of his hand.
"Hard as a rock, Chthonia. Hot as hell in the heart. Volcanic. We've all known the heat of the deep mines. We all know how the lava spurts up sometimes without warning. It's in us all, and it wrought us all. Hard as rock with a burning heart. Sit, sit, take wine. Forgive my outburst. I'd have you close. Half a Morneval is better than nothing."
They sat on the couch facing him. Horus took up a fresh cup and poured wine from a silver ewer.
The wise one and the quiet one, he said.
Locum wasn't sure which the War Master thought he was.
Counsel me, then. You were both entirely too silent during that debate.
Axemand cleared his throat.
Ezekiel had a point, he began.
He stiffened as he saw the War Master raise his eyebrows.
Go on, little one.
We prosecute this crusade according to certain doctrines. For 2 centuries we have done so. Laws of life, laws on which the Imperium is founded. They are not arbitrary. They were given to us to uphold by the Emperor himself.
Beloved of all, Horus said.
The Emperor's doctrines have guided us since the start. We have never disobeyed them.
Axemand paused, then added,
Before.
You think this is disobedience, little one?
Horus asked. Axemand shrugged.
What about you, Gavial?
Horus asked.
Are you with Axemand on this?
Locan looked back into the War Master's eyes.
I know why we ought to make war upon the Interrex, sir, he said. What interests me is why you think we shouldn't.
Horus smiled.
At last, a thinking man.
He rose to his feet and, carrying his cup carefully, walked across to the right-hand wall of the stateroom, a section of which had been richly decorated with a mural. The painting showed the Emperor, ascendant above all, catching the spinning constellations in his outstretched hand.
The stars, Horus said. See there, how he scoops them up. The zodiacs swirl into his grasp like fireflies. The stars are mankind's birthright, that's what he told me. That's one of the first things he told me when we met. I was like a child then, raised up from nothing. He set me at his side and pointed to the heavens. Those points of light, he said, are what we have been waiting generations to master. Imagine, Horus, everyone a human culture, everyone a realm of beauty and magnificence, free from strife, free from war, free from bloodshed, and the tyrannous oppression of alien overlords. Make no mistake, he said, and they will be ours.
Horus slowly traced his fingers across the whirl of painted stars until his hand met the image of the Emperor's hand. He took his touch away and looked back at Axemand and Locan.
As a foundling, on Chthonia, I saw the stars very infrequently. The sky was so often thick with foundry smoke and ash. But you remember, of course.
Yes, said Locan.
Little Horus nodded.
On those few nights when the stars were visible, I wondered at them. Wondered what they were and what they meant. Little mysterious sparks of light. They had to have some purpose in being there. I wondered such things every day of my life until the Emperor came. I was not surprised when he told me how important they were. I'll tell you a thing,
said Horus, walking back to them and resuming his seat.
The first thing my father gave me was an astrological text. It was a simple thing, a child's primer. I have it here somewhere. He noted my wonder in the stars, and wished me to learn and understand.
He paused. Locum was always captivated whenever Horus began to refer to the Emperor as my father. It had happened a few times since Locum had been part of the Inner Circle, and on every occasion it had led to unguarded revelations.
There were zodiac charts in it, in the text.
Horus took a sip of his wine and smiled at the memory.
I learned them all, in one evening. Not just the names, but the patterns, the associations, the structure. All 20 signs. The next day, my father laughed at my appetite for knowledge. He told me that the zodiac signs were old and unreliable models, now that the explorator fleets had begun detailed cosmological mapping. He told me that the 20 signs in the heavens would one day be matched by 20 suns like me. Each sun would embody the character and notion of a particular zodiac group. He asked me which one I liked the best.
What did you answer? Locan asked.
Horus sat back and chuckled.
I told him I liked all the patterns they made. I told him I was glad to finally have names for the sparks of light in the sky. I told him I liked Leos, naturally, for his regal fury, and Scorpos for his armour and warlike blade. I told him that Toramach appealed to my sense of stubbornness, and Arbitos to my sense of fairness and balance.
The Warmaster shook his head sadly.
My father said he admired my choices, but was surprised I had not picked another in particular. He showed me again the horseman with the bow, the galloping warrior, the dreadful Sagittary, he said, most warlike of all, strong, relentless, unbridled, swift and sure of his mark. In ancient times, he told me, this was the greatest sign of all. The centaur, the horseman, the hunter-warrior, had been beloved in the old ages. In Anatoly, in his own childhood, the centaur had been a revered symbol. A rider upon a horse, so he said, armed with a bow. The most potent martial instrument of its age, conquering all before it. Over time, myth had blended horseman and steed into one form. The perfect synthesis of man and war machine. That is what you must learn to be, he told me. That is what you must master. One day, you must command my armies, my instruments of war, as if they were an extension of your own person. Man and horse as one, galloping the heavens, submitting to no foe. At Ulanor, he gave me this.
Horus set down his cup and leaned forward to show them the weathered gold ring he wore on the smallest finger of his left hand. It was so eroded by age that the image was indistinct. Loken thought he could detect hooves, a man's arm, a bent bow.
It was made in Persia, the year before the Emperor was born, the dreadful Sagittary. This is you now, he said to me, my war master, my centaur, half man, half army, embedded in the legions of the Imperium. Where you turn, so the legions turn. Where you move, so they move. Where you strike, so they strike. Ride on without me, my son, and the armies will ride with you.
There was a long silence.
So you see, Horus smiled, I am predisposed to like the dreadful Sagittary. Now we meet him face to face.
His smile was infectious. Both Loken and Aximand nodded and laughed.
Now tell them the real reason, a voice said.
They turned. Sanguinius stood in an archway at the far end of the chamber, behind a veil of white silk. He had been listening. The Lord of Angels brushed the silk hanging aside and stepped into the stateroom, the crests of his wings brushing the glossy material. He was dressed in a simple white robe, clasped at the waist with a girdle of gold links. He was eating fruit from a bowl. Loken and Aximand stood up quickly.
Sit down, Sanguinius said. My brother's in the mood to open his heart, so you had better hear the truth.
I don't believe, Horus began.
Sanguinius scooped one of the small red fruits from his bowl and threw it at Horus.
Tell them the rest, he sniggered.
Horus caught the thrown fruit, gazed at it, then bit into it. He wiped the juice off his chin with the back of his hand and looked across at Loken and Aximand.
Remember the start of my story, he asked. What the Emperor said to me about the stars. Make no mistake, and they will be ours.
He took another two bites, threw the fruit stone away, and swallowed the flesh before he continued.
Sanguinius, my dear brother, is right. For Sanguinius has always been my conscience.
Sanguinius shrugged, an odd gesture for a giant with furled wings.
Make no mistake,
Horus continued.
Those three words. Make no mistake. I am Warmaster, by the Emperor's decree. I cannot fail him. I cannot make mistakes.
Sir,
Aximand ventured.
Since Ulanor, little one, I have made two. Or been party to two, and that is enough. For the responsibility of all expedition mistakes falls to me in the final count.
What mistakes? Asked Logan.
Mistakes. Misunderstandings. Horace stroked his hand across his brow. 6319. Our first endeavor. My first as War Master. How much blood was spilt there? Blood from misunderstanding. We misread the signs and paid the price. Poor dear St. Janus. I miss him still. That whole war, even that nightmare up on the mountains you had to endure, Gavil. A mistake. I could have handled it differently. 6319 could have been brought to compliance without bloodshed.
No, sir, said Logan emphatically. They were too set in their ways, and their ways were set against us. We could not have made them compliant without a war.
Horace shook his head. You are kind, Gavil, but you are mistaken. There were ways. There should have been ways. I should have been able to sway that civilization without a shot being fired. The Emperor would have done so.
I don't believe he would, Axelman said.
Then there's murder,
Horace continued, ignoring little Horace's remark.
Or Spiderland, as the Interrex has it. What is the way of their name for it again?
Orisarak, Sanguinius said, helpfully. Though I think the word only works with the appropriate harmonic accompaniment.
Spiderland will suffice then, said Horace. What did we waste there? What misunderstandings did we make? The Interrex left us warnings to stay away, and we ignored them. An embargoed world, an asylum for the creatures they had bested in war, and we walked straight in.
We weren't to know, Sanguinius said.
We should have known, Horace snapped.
Therein lies the difference between our philosophy and that of the Interrex, Axeman said. We cannot endure the existence of a malign alien race. They subjugate it, but refrain from annihilating it. Instead, they deprive it of space travel and exile it to a prison world.
We annihilate, said Horace. They find a means around such drastic measures. Which of us is the most humane?
Axeman rose to his feet.
I find myself with Ezekiel on this. Tolerance is weakness. The Interrex is admirable, but it is forgiving and generous in its dealings with Xenos breeds who deserve no quarter.
It has brought them to book, and learned to live in sympathy, said Horace. It has trained the Kinnibrak to...
And that's the best example I can offer, Axeman replied. The Kinnibrak. It embraces them as part of its culture.
I will not make another rash or premature decision, Horace stated flatly. I have made too many, and my war mastery is threatened by my mistakes. I will understand the Interrex, and learn from it, and parley with it, and only then will I decide if it has strayed too far. They are a fine people. Perhaps we can learn from them for a change.
The music was hard to get used to. Sometimes it was magisterial and loud, especially when the Meturge players struck up. And sometimes it was just a quiet whisper, like a buzz, like tinnitus, but it seldom went away. The people of the Interrex called it the Aria, and it was a fundamental part of their communication. They still used language. Indeed, their spoken language was an evolved human dialect closer in form to the prime language of Terra than Chthonic. But they had long ago formulated the Aria as an accompaniment, an enhancement of speech, and as a mode of translation. Scrutinized by the iterators during the voyage, the Aria proved to be hard to define. Essentially, it was a form of high mathematics, a universal constant that transcended linguistic barriers. But the mathematical structures were expressed through specific harmonic and melodic modes, which, to the untrained ear, sounded like music. Strands of complex melody rang in the background of all the Interrex's vocal transmissions, and when one of their kind spoke face to face, it was usual to have one or more of the Meturge players accompany his speech with their instruments. The Meturge players were the translators and envoys. Tall, like all the people of the Interrex, they wore long coats of a glossy, green fibre, laced with slender gold piping. The flesh of their ears was distended and splayed by genetic and surgical enhancement.
like the ears of bats or other nocturnal flyers. Comm technology, the equivalent of Vox, was laced around the high collars of their coats, and each one carried an instrument strapped across his chest, a device with amplifiers and coiled pipes, and numerous digital keys on which the Metaurge player's nimble fingers constantly rested. A swan-necked mouthpiece rose from the top of each instrument, enabling the player to blow, hum, or vocalize into the device. The first meeting between Imperium and Interrex had been formal and cautious. Envoys came aboard the Vengeful Spirit, escorted by Metaurge players and soldiers. The envoys were uniformly handsome and lean, with piercing eyes. Their hair was dressed short, and intricate dermatoglyphics, Loken suspected permanent tattoos, decorated either the left or right-hand sides of their faces. They wore knee-length robes of a soft, pale blue cloth, under which they were dressed in close-fitting clothing woven from the same glossy fibre that composed the Metaurge players' coats. The soldiers were impressive. 50 of them, led by officers, had descended from their shuttle. Taller than the envoys, they were clad from crown to toe in metal armour of burnished silver and emerald green, with aposematic chevrons of scarlet. The armour was of almost delicate design, and sheathed their bodies tightly. It was in no way as massive or heavy-set as the Astartes plate. The soldiers, variously Gleaves or Sagittars, Loken learned, were almost as tall as the Astartes, but with their far more slender build and more closely fitted armour, they seemed slight compared to the Imperial giants. Abaddon, at the first meeting, muttered that he doubted their fancy armour would stand even a slap. Their weapons caused more remarks. Most of the soldiers had swords sheathed across their backs. Some, the Gleaves, carried long-bladed metal spears with heavy ball counterweights on the base ends. The others, the Sagittars, carried recurved bows wrought from some dark metal. The Sagittars had sheaves of long, flightless darts laced to their right thighs.
"Bows?" Togaden whispered. "Really?
They stun us with the power and scale of their vessels, then come aboard carrying bows?
They're probably ceremonial,"
Axeman murmured. The soldier officers wore serrated half-discs across the skulls of their helmets. The visors of their close-fitting helms were all alike, the metal modelled to the lines of brow and cheekbone and nose, with simple oval eyelets that were backlit blue. The mouth and chin area of each visor was built out like a thrusting, pugnacious jaw, containing a communication module. Behind the slender soldiers, as a further escort, came heavier forms. Shorter and far more thick-set, these men were similarly armoured, though in browns and golds. Loken supposed them to be heavy troopers, their bodies gene-bred for bulk and muscle, designed for close combat, but they carried no weapons. There were 20 of them, and they flanked 5 robotic creatures, slender, silver quadrupeds of intricate and elegant design, made to resemble the finest terror-stock horses, except that they possessed no heads or necks.
"Artificials," Horus whispered aside to Malagast. "Make sure Master Regulus is observing this via the picked feed. I'll want his notes later."
One of the flagship's embarkation decks had been entirely cleared for the ceremonial meeting. Imperial banners had been hung along the vault, and the whole of First Company assembled in full plate as an honour guard. The Astartes formed 2 unwavering blocks of white figures, rigid and still, their front rows a glossy black line of Justerian Terminators. In the aisle between the 2 formations, Horus stood with a Mournival, Malagurst and other senior officials like Ing Mei Sing. The War Master and his lieutenants bore full armour and cloaks, though Horus's head was bare. They watched the heavy Interrex shuttle move ponderously down the lighted runway of the deck and settle on polished skids. Then, hatch ramps in its prow opened, the white metal unfolding like giant origami puzzles, and the envoys and their escorts disembarked. In total, with the soldiers and the Metaurge players, there were over 100 of them. They came to a halt, with the envoys in a line at the front and the escort arranged in perfect symmetry behind. 48 hours of intense intership communication had preceded that cautious moment. 48 hours of delicate diplomacy. Horus gave a nod, and the men of First Company chested their weapons and bowed their heads in one loud, unified motion. Horus himself stepped forward and walked alone down the aisle space, his cloak billowing behind him. He came face to face with what seemed to be the senior envoy, made the sign of the Aquila, and bowed.
"I greet you on," he began.
The moment he started speaking, the Meturge players began sounding their instruments softly. Horus stopped.
"Translation form,"
the envoy said, his own words accompanied by Meturge playing.
"It is disconcerting,"
Horus smiled.
"For purposes of clarity and comprehension,"
the envoy said.
"We appear to understand each other well enough,"
Horus smiled. The envoy nodded curtly.
"Then I will tell the players to stop,"
he said.
"No,"
said Horus.
"Let us be natural, if this is your way."
Again, the envoy nodded. The exchange continued, surrounded by the oddly melodied playing.
"I greet you on behalf of the Emperor of Mankind, beloved by all, and in the name of the Imperium of Terra."
"On behalf of the Society of the Interrex, I accept your greetings and return them."
"Thank you," said Horus.
"Of the first thing,"
the envoy said,
"you are from Terra?"
"Yes."
"From old Terra, that was also called Earth?"
"Yes."
"This can be verified?"
"By all means,"
smiled Horus.
"You know of Terra?"
An odd expression, like a pang, crossed the envoy's face, and he glanced round at his colleagues.
"We are from Terra. Ancestrally. Genetically. It was our origin world, eons ago. If you are truly of Terra, then this is a momentous occasion. For the first time in thousands of years, the Interrex has established contact with its lost cousins."
"It is our purpose in the stars," Horus said, "to find all the lost families of man, cast away so long ago."
The envoy bowed his head.
"I am Dias Shen, Abracarius."
"I am Horus, Warmaster."
The music of the Meturge players made a slight but noticeably discordant sound as it expressed Warmaster. Shen frowned.
"Warmaster,"
he repeated.
"The rank given to me personally by the Emperor of Mankind, so that I may act as his most senior lieutenant."
"It is a robust title. Bellicose. Is your fleet a military undertaking?"
"It has a military component. Space is too dangerous for us to roam unarmed. But from the look of your fine soldiers, Abracarius, so does yours."
Shen pursed his lips.
"You laid assault to Erisarak with great aggression and vehemence, and in disregard to the advisory beacons we had positioned in the system. It would appear your military component is a considerable one."
"We will discuss this in detail later, Abracarius. If an apology needs to be made, you will hear it directly from me. First, let me welcome you in peace."
Horus turned and made a signal. The entire company of Astartes and the plated officers locked off their weapons and removed their helms. Human faces, row after row. Openness, not hostility. Shen and the other envoys bowed and made a signal of their own, a signal supported by a musical sequence. The warriors of the Interrex removed their visors, displaying clean, hard-eyed faces. Except for the squat figures, the heavy troops in brown and gold. When their helmets came off, they revealed faces that weren't human at all. They were called the Kinnebrach, an advanced, mature species. They had been an interstellar culture for over 15,000 years. They had already founded a strong, multi-world civilization in the local region of space before Terra had entered its first age of technology, an era when humanity was only just feeling its way beyond the solar system in sublight vehicles. By the time the Interrex encountered them, their culture was aging and fading. A territorial war developed after initial contact and lasted for a century. Despite the Kinnebrach's superior technology, the humans of the Interrex were victorious. But, in victory, they did not annihilate the aliens. Rapprochement was achieved. thanks in part to the Interrex's willingness to develop the Aria to facilitate a more profound level of interspecies communication. Faced with options including further warfare and exile, the Kinnebrach elected to become client citizens of the expanding Interrex. It suited them to place their tired, flagging destiny in the charge of the vigorous and progressive humans. Culturally bonded as junior partners in society, the Kinnebrach shared their technological advances by way of exchange. For 3,000 years, the Interrex humans had successfully coexisted with the Kinnebrach. Conflict with the Kinnebrach was our first significant alien war, Daeth Shen explained. He was seated with the other envoys in the War Master's audience chamber. The Mournival was present, and Metarch players lined the walls, gently accompanying the talks. It taught us a great deal. It taught us about our place in the cosmos, and certain values of compassion, understanding, and empathy. The Aria developed directly from it, as a tool for use in further dealings with non-human parties. The war made us realize that our very humanity, or at least our trenchant dependence on human traits, such as language, was an obstacle to mature relations with other species. No matter how sophisticated the means, Abracarius, Abaddon said, sometimes communication is not enough. In our experience, most Xenos types are willfully hostile. Communication and bargaining is not an option. The first captain, like many present, was uncomfortable. The entire Interrex party had been permitted to enter the audience chamber, and the Kinnebrach were attending at the far end. Abaddon kept glancing at them. They were hefty, simian things, with eyes so oddly sunken beneath big brow ridges that they were just sparks in shadows. Their flesh was blue-black and deeply creased, with fringes of russet hair, so fine it was almost like feather down, surrounding the bases of their heavy, angular craniums. Mouth and nose was one organ, a trifold split at the end of their blunt jaw snouts, capable of peeling back wet and pink to sniff, or opening laterally to reveal a comb of small, sharp teeth like a dolphin's beak. There was a smell to them, a distinctive, earthy smell that wasn't exactly unpleasant, except that it was entirely and completely not human. "This we have found ourselves," Shen agreed, "though it would seem less frequently than you. Sometimes we have encountered a species that has no wish to exchange with us, that approaches us with predatory or invasive intent. Sometimes conflict is the only option. Such was the case with the... what did you say you called them again?"
"Megarachnid," Hora smiled.
Shen nodded and smiled.
"I see how that word is formed. From the old roots. The Megarachnid were highly advanced, but not sentient in a way we could understand. They existed only to reproduce and develop territory. When we first met them, they infested 8 systems along the Shatil edge of our provinces, and threatened to invade and choke 2 of our populated worlds. We went to war to safeguard our own interests. In the end, we were victorious, but there was still no opportunity for rapprochement or peace terms. We gathered all the Megarachnid remaining into captivity and transported them to Urisarak. We also deprived them of all their interstellar technology, or the means to manufacture the same. Urisarak was created as a reservation for them, where they might exist without posing a threat to ourselves or others. The interdiction beacons were established to warn others away.
You did not consider exterminating them? Malagurst asked. Shen shook his head.
What right do we have to make another species extinct? In most cases, an understanding can be reached. The Megarachnid were an extreme example where exile was the only humane option.
The approach you describe is a fascinating one, Horus said quickly,
seeing that Abaddon was about to speak again.
I believe it is time for that apology, Abracarius. We misunderstood your methods and purpose on Urisarak. We violated your reservation. The Imperium apologizes for its transgression.